Got it.
All right. Intimate little group here, Thanksgiving holiday. I haven't turned on the microphone yet.
Oh. Too.
All right. All right, can you hear me through that speaker? Does it, do you wanna? We are testing the using amplification in the Zendo as well as doing the Zoom thing. Oh. There I am. And all right, we good? Could you turn the webcam on top of the TV to, oh, Chip will do it. To show more of the people in the Zendo. We do a switcheroo on the cameras. All right. We go. All right. Welcome, everyone. We'll go around and greet people, starting with those on Zoom, and we'll all repeat everybody's name after. I'll say it on Zoom, and then in the Zendo, each person says their own name. So starting with Tyler, Nick, Mark, Bob, and Betty. Yesesoki, Paul, Marv, Karen, Sabrina, Paulette, and Ruth Ann, and in the Zendo,
Anna,
Judith, Rich, and Erica. Right. Ah, okay. In terms of announcements, December 12th, we have a guest speaker on Sunday, Thomas Bruner, who has been a speaker here a few times before, and I believe he's going to come in person, so people are able and want to come on that Sunday, he should be here. And then not too long before holiday break, but we will, you know, we miss two Tuesdays and one Sunday, but you know, a lot of times as the holidays approach, attendance goes off quite a lot because people are just getting into holiday mode. But we will be here offering our regularly scheduled programming, so. Okay. tonight's class, this is the last class on the 9 fields of Zen practice. And then next week, we will begin on the new book by one of my teachers, Kyogen Carlson, You Are Still Here. Bob's showing that. And you can find more information on the website and in the in the weekly email newsletter. And we won't be reading the whole book. I've already given talks on a few of the chapters, and it's, you know, we would have to study it for the better part of a year. So check the website for the which chapters we will be reading each week. Should be interesting. All right. So this class is on bodhisattva activity, and I think everyone here is familiar with the 9 fields, but if you aren't, this is a formulation of practice that I came up with, and you can find it on the Zen Studies podcast website, and actually you can find it on the Brightway Zen website too, because I put a link to all the recordings of these classes. So either website, you can go look for the 9 fields and find connections to the other website. And so you can listen to the past classes on this, and I've also done a bunch of podcast episodes that are relevant to these different fields of practice. This last field is bodhisattva activity, or as I've been teaching this, I've changed the kind of taglines a few times, and now I'm calling it bodhisattva activity, living by vow. And I think on the previous formulation, it was working to save all beings or something like that, which is part of the bodhisattva vow, but you'll see tonight why I kind of wanted to emphasize vow. So for those of you who aren't familiar, there is a fourfold bodhisattva vow that is associated with Mahayana Buddhism, with Zen, which with our lineage. And it's taking it is optional, as all aspects of our practice are optional, with the exception of just basic respectfulness and ethical behavior. Zazen is optional, Dharma study is optional, cultivating insight is optional. As Mahayana Buddhists, however, we're encouraged to take the bodhisattva vows. So the fourfold bodhisattva vow is, beings are numberless, I vow to free them. And it doesn't say, but like it's understood, I vow to free them all. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them all. The Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it, or I vow to realize it. And I was doing a little reading about the vows today, and the last one there, the Buddha way, refers not so much to the path of practice, like a way of practice, but the awakening itself. So the, you know, Buddha, awakening, liberation, enlightenment, or whatever you call it, is unsurpassable. I vow to, you know, realize it for myself, actualize it, manifest it. So you may have made these vows or continue to make them before we chant them on Saturday mornings after sitting. They're often chanted once a day in monasteries or other practice settings. And in our Soto Zen Zaikei or Shuke Tokudo ceremonies, so Shuke Tokudo is the monastic ordination ceremony, and the Zaikei Tokudo is a step of vow for lay people. And we have this passage, because all existence is marked by dukkha, we begin our practice for the sake of our own suffering. Because all existence shares the same Buddha heart, we broaden our practice for the sake of others. Because the Dharma is unfathomably deep, we undertake endless practice for the sake of the Dharma. If you want to train in the precepts in this threefold manner, you should now undertake the fourfold Bodhisattva vow. So then in the process of those ceremonies, we take this fourfold vow. So what is this really about? If you have taken these vows, or you've thought about chanting these vows, do you really mean it? Do you actually aspire to complete Buddhahood? Do you intend to work selflessly as long as there is any being in the world that is suffering? Do you intend to diligently practice to untangle your karma and awaken to reality, never giving up until complete enlightenment? Do you really vow to take every advantage of every opportunity to grow and learn? That is, enter every Dharma gate. When you phrase the vow in this literal way, which is what it says, I don't think many of us can claim to sincerely aspire to all of this, let alone claim to have made much progress. Think about what you're satisfied with in practice. Chances are, much like me, you would like to live with a little more peace of mind, access more compassion, maybe gain a few liberating insights, free yourself from a couple of your annoying, persistent habits. You'd probably like to be a decent friend, partner, parent, child, sibling, coworker, to be ethical, trusted by people, and generous within reason. Not becoming like a doormat or anything, just a little less stingy and judgmental. Or maybe you just mostly want to accept yourself and your life just as it is, and thereby gain more peace and happiness. Frankly, most of us don't aspire to all that much. Now, some of us, it's true, we get excited at first in practice, get kind of obsessed, usually secretly, with a goal of gaining insight into emptiness, or living each moment of our day mindfully, or attaining such ethical and selfless behavior that people recognize we are worthy of respect. Maybe they'll even ask us to be a teacher, or at the very least, listen to our wisdom. But after a while, we give up these goals in frustration, or we recognize they're just the small self co-opting our spiritual practice. So what are these ambitious Bodhisattva vows for then? So in the book, which I recommend, Living by Vow, Shohaku Okumura explains, from the beginning, especially in Mahayana Buddhism, vow is essential for all bodhisattvas. In fact, part of the definition of a bodhisattva is a person who lives by vow instead of by karma. Karma means habit, preferences, or a ready-made system of values. As we grow up, we learn a system of values from the culture around us, which we use to evaluate the world and choose actions. This is karma and living by karma. In contrast, a bodhisattva lives by vow. Vow is like a magnet or a compass that shows us the direction toward the Buddha. So vow gives shape to our lives. We don't make vows over things over which we have no control or say. Like, I vow to obey the law of gravity. I vow to grow old. You know, that doesn't make any sense. We make vows about things we may very well fail to do, but which we want to do because that's the way we want to live. That's the kind of life we want to have. So the Bodhisattva vows are deliberately phrased to be impossible. And, you know, so that was, I vow to, beings are numberless, I vow to free them all. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them all. The Buddha way is unsurpassable, I vow to embody it, or accomplish it. So Okamura says again, there is a contradiction inherent in these vows. We vow to do things that are impossible. This means our practice is endless, and we cannot completely fulfill the four vows. Our practice and study are like trying to empty the ocean with a spoon, one spoonful at a time. It is certainly a stupid way of life, not a clever one. A clever person cannot be a bodhisattva. We are aiming at something eternal, infinite, and absolute. No matter how much we practice, study, and help other people, there is no end to it all. When we compare our achievement with something infinite, absolute, and eternal, it's like nothing. So I always think of it as like, if we all vowed to, we're each going to free three beings, then, you know, you could keep track. You could like, well, oh, you've saved two. Oh, I see. You got another one to go. But when you've just, you vowed to save them all, you vowed to end all delusions, it's just, you don't even bother to keep track. Just, are you still going in the right direction? So we make, and yet we make a sincere vow, not a half-hearted or an automatic or rote vow, like with our fingers crossed behind our back, like, yeah, right. We do try to cultivate faith we can really fulfill these vows. We can really awaken and benefit ourselves and all beings. And this may be an unfair comparison. I apologize if anyone is Christian and feels this, but I thought it was a worthwhile comparison to make just because most of us have much more of a grounding in Judeo-Christian background than in Buddhism. So this aspiration to Buddhahood, it's different than Christianity, where you might aspire to be Christ-like. But it's understood you can't possibly approach his divine being, his divine spiritual perfection. And you need Christ's power for redemption. Doing your best is all anyone can ask you to do, and then you're a mere sinner, but you will get a reward in heaven if your faith is strong enough. So instead, although we admire the Buddha and various people through the ages who have attained some kind of rare spiritual attainment, the path of Buddhism is something we ourselves walk. And if ordinary people like us can't approach the same insight and liberation as the Buddha, then this path doesn't work and all of its claims are false. That is where the essence of it is. At the same time, of course, the raw stuff of our lives usually doesn't look very Buddha-like. So I had this image of we're trying to craft a Buddha statue, and we're just learning how to work clay or carve stone. And so, you know, we've got this Buddha statue in process. And, you know, I mean, it's kind of triangular, it's kind of, but it basically just looks like a big lump. We're working on it. It's clearly there's somebody working on it. But it's far from recognizable. But there's a certain kind of completeness and perfection just in that effort. You know, just as we would if, you know, an artist had something in progress, or if a child's learning skills or something, you know, you don't look at it and say, oh, well, that's worthless because it's not a fine piece of art. It is just what it is. It's in process. And the aspiration embodied in it is really the most important thing. So our vows guide our efforts. And they're there as a reference point when we need to make decisions, arrange priorities. So when we talk about Buddhas or Bodhisattvas, sometimes we'll say a Bodhisattva does this, or a Buddha does this, or whatever. We're just talking about an ideal. It doesn't really matter, at least to me, whether anyone has ever perfectly attained these ideals. Maybe, I mean, certainly I know some people more than others, but we know the direction is meaningful. We know it's a valuable direction to go. More is possible. It doesn't matter whether the end result of perfection is possible. So these vows, these Bodhisattva vows, are something that we take on, and they mean, in a sense, you know, if you just pictured them being absent from the nine fields. And so you were doing, you know, Zazen, Dharma study, precepts, and all these things. But what you would have was a list of techniques, tools for study or improvement or whatever. But the vow itself, to add that in and say, it's like upping the ante. Saying, I'm doing this for a purpose. I want my life to embody growth and learning and exploration. So it's really it's like the yeast, the yeast in the dough. So the four vows, so the second, third, and fourth vows, so that's delusions, Dharma gates, and the Buddha way, are less often discussed. What do they really mean to us? Does anybody else smell something like it's kind of burning?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't think so. Excuse us for a moment. I am hearing something from over by that. Anybody want to? You want to check out in the hall there? Huh?
Not out here.
Huh. Yeah. Maybe it's just is the candle really low over here?
Yeah.
It might be
it just sputtered out.
Oh, never mind. It's the candle on the altar just sputtered out.
Or it's really low.
Maybe we want to blow it out so that it's, we think it's just the candle on this altar.
Mm. Yes.
Didn't want the Zendo to burn down as I talked. Okay. So our second, third, and fourth vows. They're less often discussed. So a lot of times when we talk about Bodhisattvas, we talk about the freeing all beings part. And I'll get to that. But I briefly wanted to talk about the second, third, and fourth, which, what do they really mean? And I would say that means the diligent practice of the nine fields, however you like to formulate your practice, means continuous practice, never ending, never being satisfied. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. The Buddha way is, you know, beyond comprehension, but I vow to actualize it. So isn't never being satisfied contrary to practice? I mean, aren't we supposed to give up desire and, you know, be content, be happy? Now, the kind of satisfaction we're really looking for is not self-satisfaction, as in, I know everything I need to know. I've done all the growing I need to do. Seems to be the I don't know, maybe it's the batteries coming in and out, sorry.
It's okay.
I've done all the growing I need to do. I'm about as good as I'm ever gonna get. From here on, I'll just coast. So, you know, you could be satisfied with who you are and who your life is, but there's a kind of static satisfaction there. But it's entirely possible to maintain what I've talked about on the podcast before as samvega, or spiritual urgency, while still being profoundly at peace with our lives just as they are. True satisfaction being not a static thing. It's not about, like, we've found a sufficiently pleasant set of circumstances and so we're good and we don't really want it to change. But the true satisfaction being is part of a process. We're satisfied because we're still in the process of growing and learning and moving through the course of our lives. So full engagement in life and all of its possibilities. So that's the, like, second, third, and fourth is kind of never getting complacent in our practice. I mean, we do, but that our vow is not to get complacent. So then freeing all beings from suffering. So part of this I've heard before is, like, we're vowing to free all beings from ourselves. That's part of why we work on ourselves, is so that we free other beings from our unreasonableness or harm. But another aspect of this is partaking of responsibility. I would say the Bodhisattva never, ever says, that's not my problem. Because of interdependence, it said the Bodhisattva cherishes all living beings as if they were her only child. So it's not just a matter of, like, hyper virtue. From the point of view of Buddhism, this is a sentiment that reflects reality. It reflects the fact that we are all actually interconnected, interdependent. What happens to you in some ways happens to me. So therefore that kind of compassion and care arises naturally. And yet we can't free all beings. They're numberless. And even the ones around us are darn difficult to free. So what does this vow even mean? So I talked about this a little bit on Sunday in a different context, but I see it as maintaining, cultivating willingness, openness, generosity. So the three ways that I was talking about doing this in the context of Bodhisattva practice on Sunday was what my three ingredients of bearing witness, taking care, and taking action. staying engaged because we are needed. We may have very humble opinions of ourselves, but this, like, we are needed. So when contemplating practice in the field of bodhisattva activity, we would say, don't undersell yourself and don't oversell yourself. So if you undersell yourself, you say, oh, you know, there's that, I don't have anything to contribute. We oversell ourselves, we think, here I come, sentient beings, I am going to save you. And, you know, either one is really not going to be sustainable or beneficial for long. So each of these fields, as I've said before, complement each other. So this isn't just a matter of, I mean, it is and it isn't, but it's not just a matter of virtue. Be a good person. Help other people and be a good person. It's if we enact this generosity and engagement and openness, we'll also gain insight from it. So it's, you know, in some ways it's like the fake it till you make it. Like, act in this generous bodhisattva way and you become more bodhisattva like and end up with more of a bodhisattva mind and heart. And in other aspects of our practice, we're also working on letting go of self-attachment or seeing the emptiness of self, and that feeds into feeling more open and generous with beings. So one of the first questions when we talk about bodhisattva activity and generosity, one of the first questions people usually have is how do you avoid giving too much? How do you set boundaries? How do you avoid burning out, stressing yourself out, using up your resources, exhausting yourself? And I think the first thing is it's important to recognize that this does happen sometimes. We overextend, something we do fails to be beneficial, it's frustrating, the situation changes, whatever. This bodhisattva engagement in the world, which I like to picture as, sometimes we overthink it and, you know, think, what can I do? What am I capable of doing? But I think in that kind of willingness and openness, I came up with this on Sunday, like, say you happen upon the scene of an accident, you know, a car accident or something like that, and the authorities aren't there yet, you know, you've walked into this situation, and clearly there's a lot happening and a lot needs to be done. So you just walk in and you're willing. What can I do? Can I just, you know, stand next to this person with my hand on their shoulder? Can I make a call? Can I wrap a blanket around somebody? Can I, you know, go get some water? That's the kind of receptivity and willingness and openness that I feel like is an ideal bodhisattva attitude as we go about life. Just, you know, what can I do? And then sometimes that's not going to be obvious, but sometimes nothing's going to come up for right away. But I think if we walk around with that attitude, stuff will appear. So sometimes, you know, we do get burned out. We've given too much. This happens particularly, you know, we volunteer and we put in too many hours and we're burning the candle at both ends. So we're helping some family member, a friend, and it just ends up being too much. So this is just the nature of this practice, right? We go and too much, but unfortunately, sometimes then we go, hey, look, no more of that, because I got burned. But the middle way is to avoid extremes. So I could think of two different extremes that we could fall into with respect to bodhisattva activity. And one, two sets of extremes, actually. So this first set is one, I give and give and give and give without any thought for myself, never saying no. All right, so if you're that kind of person, I'm generally not that kind of person, but, you know, that's kind of a recipe for disaster or resentment or whatever. Then the other extreme from that is, you know, there's just, so that's kind of no boundaries, right? The other extreme is very kind of stingy, rigid boundaries, which there's just too much need in the world. If I open the doors of generosity, there's just going to be too much of a demand. You know, I got to look out for mine. So those are two extremes. And there's no like magical place in between where we get to just stay. It's going to be a constant negotiation of like, ooh, that wasn't, you know, I want to give a little more. Ooh, that was too much. So it's a dynamic dance in the middle. And another extreme, set of extremes, is when I am responsible for this and this, for, you know, saving these beings, for doing this bodhisattva activity, and I will die trying before I fail to achieve what I set out to do. I must fulfill the bodhisattva vow. And then, of course, the other extreme is there's so much need in the world, my contribution won't make a difference. Or I can't make any difference. So I can't fulfill the bodhisattva vow. I must fulfill the bodhisattva vow. And of course, the common element in both of those is I. Me. This is what I'm doing. But the middle way is a non-dual way. It's a lively, engaged, real-life way. So the bodhisattva walking in the middle way has his wits about him, and his own well-being is part of the equation. But he also doesn't anticipate deciding ahead of time how to respond or how generous to be. If this happens, I'll give. If this happens, I won't. If they're going to take too much and whatever. So I have, you may have your own experiences of this, but I feel like I encountered this truth in another way in Aikido, which is a Japanese self-defense martial art. And, you know, what you aim to do is to, they call it coordinate body and mind. I would say, you know, be upright like this bodhisattva who's not anticipating anything. To be, let energy move through you, be one with things, not react, right? So you then take the energy of maybe somebody who's attacking and you just, you let them fall. So you enact this in the dojo. And you learn by making mistakes. You learn by engaging with people and trying too hard, not trying hard enough, and ultimately realize that your responses are uncannily appropriate if you let go of your agenda and allow the response to arise naturally instead of trying to like, here it comes. Like no matter how fast and how skilled your response, it is not going to be as skilled as remaining center and allowing the response to arise naturally. I mean, and it takes a long time to trust this, to build that up. But over time, we can begin to trust that response. So I wanted to share, before wrapping my part up, an important aspect of bodhisattva practice from the Diamond Sutra. So this gets a little bit of what I'm talking about in the kind of the, we want to undertake this bodhisattva activity, but it really isn't what we think it is. We think it's I, you know, out there doing these activities that are going to benefit other beings, but it's really more like a participation. instead of, you know, a constriction of resources, it's letting resources flow. It's recognizing interdependence. So this is from the Diamond Sutra. The Buddha said, Subhuti, someone who sets forth on the Bodhisattva path should give birth to the thought. In the realm of complete nirvana, I shall liberate all beings. And while I thus liberate beings, not a single being is liberated. And why? Subhuti, a bodhisattva who creates the perception of a being cannot be called a bodhisattva. Neither can someone who creates the perception of a life or even the perception of a soul be called a bodhisattva. And why not? Subhuti, there is no such dharma as setting forth on the bodhisattva path. So this is pointing at the independent dimension of reality, the sense in which we conceive of a bodhisattva path and bodhisattva activity and bodhisattvas and Buddhism and practice and me and you and all of this, but that's really just a conventional designation that we give to reality. It's a way that we, you know, we describe it, we communicate about it, we organize it, but it isn't reality itself. So the second that we start to think, I mean, and of course we think this, right? It's not saying that we have to like be ashamed for just being human beings with brains that do this. But when we start to think, I am giving this to you, I am doing this for your behalf, or you are doing this on my behalf, or it's limited. It's getting away from the essence of what we're talking about here. I mean, we got to start somewhere. And so, like I said, it's fake it till you make it. It'll go ahead and do something generous, even though you have an idea, I'm doing something generous. But hold that question of, you know, what is deeper here? In what sense is this benefit just flowing through? In what sense am I benefited from my own bodhisattva activity just as much as anybody else? So I guess that is where I will leave it. And we have a little over 15 minutes to talk about bodhisattva activity and the bodhisattva vows. So if you have any questions about the vows and how we hold them, please feel free. We'll just go ahead and sit in silence for a minute. If you feel called to say something, please do. Chris.
Hi there, Domio. One of the things that's always struck me in thinking about the language, and I realize it's a translation, so that there was some choice in the words that were used when it was given the English words that we say, but it strikes me that one of the contradictions or sort of like kind of magical properties of the words is that, like, saying beings are numberless, I'm quick to hear it as like there, it's a huge number, like it's so big that it's not countable, but it's just as easily to invert that and say that they're numberless, like there's none, or like to say that a gate is boundless, like you're using the word boundless, and bound is tied to boundaries, tied to the definition of it, and a gate that is boundless isn't really a gate. And I just I kind of like to live in that piece of it as well. And like another kind of aspect of that same kind of contradiction or like inversion, you touched on at the beginning of the talk where you said you were imagining like, oh, what if we tracked it? And what if you're responsible for three and I'm responsible for three, and then you've got two, so we know you have one more to go. Like the idea that everybody who on a daily basis is saying beings are numberless, I vow to free them all. Well, if you freed some, then I can't free them all because you've already taken care of some. So like, you can't have this overlap. And I think that that's just so fun. Like to just sit there and think about, like, there's no beings, I'm going to free them, as much as there's so many beings, I'm going to free them. I don't know. That's just a reflection that I have. And I kind of wonder what the original language actually might've sounded like. And if it was similar, if it just got tangled up in English, to paraphrase Bob Dylan.
I like it. I mean, I know that I'm not sure about the numberless part, but I do believe that the Dharma gates are boundless is a pretty accurate. And you're right. Like, what's a boundless gate? Like, you can just go into it, right? There's not even going into it. It has no edges. Yeah, I think that's beautiful. And just like, it's just like with our precepts, which we have these, you know, these very specific guidelines for behavior. And then in our precept booklet, we have, you know, one ancestor who says, you know, basically it's impossible to even keep them. Like to say not one word is to not speak dishonestly. And then the other ancestor says, basically, you can't break it. So it's like, yeah, I think it's important to hold both of those. There are no beings, I vow to free them. And delusions are inexhaustible sounds not just like there's lots and lots and lots of delusions, but almost like they can't be ended. You can't put them out.
Right, even the Buddha way being unsurpassable suggests you can't go past something that doesn't exist, right? Like that's the sort of the inversion of that. Like unsurpassable on face value sounds like it's so big, it's so great, but also it sounds like, well, you can't go past it because it's not even there.
The Buddha way is incomprehensible, I vow to understand it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Erica.
Who created the vows? Do we know?
So I was reading a little bit today with the in Shohaku Okamura's book. And so he has a little bit about the history in there. But apparently, he doesn't say that much about the evolution, but originally they were based on the Four Noble Truths. And so it was a little more straightforward, like, well, I'm aspiring to be a Dharma teacher. And as such, I'm going to help beings become free from suffering, see the source of suffering. So that's the second one. Attain the give up desires and, you know, attain that cessation of suffering. Then the fourth is the Eightfold Path. So basically it was promising to help beings enter the four noble truths. And then, but then at some point, like, cause this is a transition from original Buddhism to Mahayana, which just kind of like makes everything far out and makes it, he pointed out it became this vow that I'm not just taking as a spiritually ambitious practitioner who wants to attain the way and then share it with others, but that it becomes a vow that we all take. So even though like we're just totally on the way, we're still in the middle of delusions, you know, but we're working on it. So not sure exactly when it started to expand like that, but it goes back a long way. Like 2,000 years. Chris?
What's the difference between a bodhisattva and a mahasattva?
I think there's probably a scholarly answer to that. But I suspect, so bodhi is, you know, awakening. Enlightenment or awakening. So bodhisattvas are awakening beings. I like how it's like, it's often translated as awakening beings, like they help people awaken, or they are in the process of awakening, as opposed to they are awakened, like it's this done deal. Anyway, awakening beings, and then maha is just great, so great beings. So I think it's, you know, it's like bodhisattvas would also be great beings, Buddhas would also be great beings, but traditionally in Buddhist cosmology, there's many other beings, and some of them are great. So there's devas and dragons and, you know, spirits and all kinds of beings in the world. So if you think about that kind of imaginatively, you know, maybe bodhisattvas are people who are, you know, living by vow in this specific way, but mahasattvas are other beneficial and brilliant beings who may not be manifesting things quite the same way. And we're so grateful for them. So does this, I guess, does this field make sense in terms of like a field for Zen practice? Distinctly. I know that some folks have used the nine fields to focus their practice, or they've had a study group on them or whatever. And I imagine that this one, a little bit like a couple of them, like connecting with the ineffable or something like that, they might be a little harder to like, okay, exactly how is that supposed to look? Besides, you know, reciting the bodhisattva vows on a regular basis, you know, how could this look? Tyler.
Yeah, I really like this one. I really like the bodhisattva vows. Once I was told that, when I first heard about them, you know, it was like, and they're, you know, they're not something you're really trying to achieve, you know, as we've said, there's no, they're impossible or whatever, but that allows you to be like, okay, well, I don't have to worry about, you know, like reaching an end point, so now I can just like put my shoulders down and just do the work as best I can, right, and find ways to engage with it without necessarily worrying about like, is this going to get me there faster, or is this going to like the whole thing, right? It's just, so to me, it's a really, I really like it for that purpose of like, once you know you're not finishing this race or whatever, you can just sort of go do your best and it almost like enjoy it, enjoy your work in the bodhisattva way. Yeah.
Yeah, that's where, yeah, like it's the first time when I read Shohaku Okazumura's book and he pointed out how they're impossible and how that actually is kind of a relief. Because, yeah, you're not going to attain it this lifetime. So, Mick.
Yeah, I think one of the things that this like that I felt was put in a way that was really helpful in Diane Rosetta's book on the precepts. She like rephrased all of the precepts, and they all started with this phrase, "I vow to take up the way." And I think that that's kind of what this encapsulates, is it's like, look, all you're doing is just taking up the way. And I really have always liked that image of just like, I'm not like, you know, like planning stuff out, and I'm not like, this isn't a project that I'm going to complete or whatever. Like what you have to do is just take up the way. And that's really it, right? It's this sort of open-ended commitment that the most important thing is just to, you know, take up the way, just like get going on it. And, you know, it's not this like set thing, just take up the way.
I like it. It's like, potentially now vow ends up being, you know, there's a real art to vow, which I think over the course of practice, especially together as Sangha, we make vows, you know, the follow the precepts, and we make vows as term student, or, you know, other settings where we make vows. And sometimes we're not very good at it. We're not very good at choosing the right vow or how to relate to it. And so it becomes a practice in and of itself, is how to live by vow. But it seems like when we get it, it is a way to kind of have influence on the shape of our life long term without worrying about the future. I read something once by Gandhi who said, when you make a vow, you should stop thinking about the content of the vow. Just, you know, and it depends. Sometimes you take a vow for a set amount of time or whatever, but it's like once you set your course, just like instead of each time going like, should I do that? Should I not do that? That's kind of the point, right? Is to just like, just do it. Betty.
Sorry, I have to unmute myself. For the first vow, I've heard it or seen it written different ways. I shall save them or liberate them or free them. And those three things, or at least save versus liberate, have different connotations in my way of trying to interpret the vows. So where do those differences come from?
It is definitely one of those translation things, but originally, like I was saying, this comes from, I vow to help all beings free themselves from suffering. So it is freeing them from suffering, which from the Buddhist point of view is due to, you know, desire and craving and clinging. And if you let go of that, then you can be free from suffering. But so it sounds a little bit like what we want to do is teach all people Buddhism, right? Or we want to, like, you know, help them awaken to the Four Noble Truths, and then regardless of their circumstances, they can be free from suffering. So it sounds a little bit like we don't care about other forms of suffering or destruction or injustice or whatever. But I guess if you look at it in terms of, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs, you're unlikely to be able to teach a being to free themselves from let go of their suffering and do this spiritual work if they don't have a place to live, or if they're, you know, in danger of their lives or whatever. So I think that it's just a continuum of concern. But ultimately that is the freeing them from suffering is the deal.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, oh, Tyler.
This is just really quick, because it just popped in my head with what you were just saying. My neighbors are Jehovah's Witness, so every so often their friends knock on our door and say, like, hey, like, have you heard the good news? Are there like that sort of like Buddhist, or like, I know Zen wouldn't probably, Denkyupu wouldn't dare knock on someone's door and suggest, but like, I was curious, are there ones that go out there and like really try to spread the good news, as it were? In the saving idea, like,
not many,
okay,
but there are, I would say, the varieties of Buddhism are more varied, dare I say, than the varieties of Christianity. So I do believe that there are, I don't know, I haven't seen them around lately, but there were Namu Nyoho Renge Kyo folks. You repeat that phrase, and if you repeat it often enough and you repeat it in the right spirit, then you'll get good stuff. Like a good job, like a new refrigerator, that kind of thing. So, I mean, it manifests in many different forms, but that's really not, that's kind of a, you know, kind of a fringe thing, I think.
I do need a new fridge, so maybe I'll start. So.
That's the one that Tina Turner follows.
Yep. So it's out there. You never know. Somebody says, oh, I'm a Buddhist. And you're like, huh, well, what does that mean? All right. I will say our verse. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time. All honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas. Wisdom beyond wisdom. Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming.